Let's get going.
Oh, we are going.
Oh my Lord.
That was so good. I'm keeping that in.
Oh man.
So I went to the mall today. And I had to pick up a new Apple TV and a replacement remote. First of all, I do want to talk a little bit about my TV. So we've had this like back den slash family room slash playroom in our house since we bought the house, and we haven't had any furniture in it because we just haven't had any need for it yet. Like, we have a living room, I have an office, like we have separate rooms for these things. So this room we always said, oh, it'll be like the kids' playroom. So we just started using this room finally now that we have the kid, and so we got a couch for it that was delivered this morning, and I got a TV for it, and a second Apple TV to plug into that TV, and I thought it was interesting how, you know, and John, of course, you're famous for your researched television purchase, but I thought it was interesting how for this TV, the only research I did was I searched Amazon for TVs in roughly this size range on my iPad mini in bed one night and just ordered it.
That's how the rest of the world lives, Marco. I learned that. So occasionally I fantasize about purchasing something that way, but I can never actually pull the trigger.
Well, and
just like, well, but it would just take 5 more minutes, just 10 more minutes. Okay, Boker, maybe just 1 more hour. Okay, maybe 3 more hours. And just think, that 3 hours you invest now, you're going to have this thing for years. Isn't it foolish to just live like other people and just search for TV and find one that looks nice and click a buy? But that's what people do.
So the reason you keep cars for 7 eternities is because it takes you 7 eternities to research the next car.
I'm reading car magazines, at least one car magazine a month. I'm continually researching what the next car is going to be. I'm always ready at a moment's notice to, sift through the existing field and say, these are the potential cars I would get. I mean, I'm even making those things of like, well, do I want the S8 or should I wait for the new S class? None of these cars I can afford, but like, I'm already, you know, just in case I'm ready to go on that front.
Goodness gracious.
I think usually I'm like that too, which is why I was kind of amused by my own lack of interest in doing that for this purchase. The main reason why I think in my case this time was, there weren't that many choices that I actually wanted. So I wasn't going to go to a store. That was like, I don't care, because it's a secondary room in the house. Selfishly, I'm not going to often be watching it. Usually either the baby's watching it with Sesame Street or my wife is watching it while hanging out with the baby. And so it is very rare that I will be there watching it. Second of all, I know that, and it had to be smaller. The biggest we could get that would fit the spot it went in was 37 inches. I know, you know, by old standards, that's pretty big, but by today's standards, that's pretty small. So, or at least medium. So it wasn't, I'm not like buying a high-end item, because John, as you told me, it's pretty hard to find small, high-end TV models.
Yeah, all small TVs are terrible.
Right.
It's sad.
So, and the other thing was, I didn't really want to buy a Samsung, because I just find Samsung so distasteful as a company overall. That I'd rather not support them if I can avoid it. Like, I mean, you know, sure, if they had the only good option, I would have probably sucked it up and bought it. But so I went, and the TV we have for our main TV, which I bought about 7 years ago now, is a nice 42-inch Panasonic plasma, and I'm very happy with it. It's great TV, 1080p, really, really nice color and brightness and contrast. Dark levels are awesome. It's the plasma. I mean, it's a fantastic TV, and I've always been very pleased with it. So I basically looked on Amazon. All right, show me TVs that are, you know, this size roughly. And of course that rules out all plasmas, which is unfortunate, because I do like plasma as a technology. It just looks so good in dark detail. But, okay. Can't get a plasma. It's 37 inches. So, and rule out Samsung, okay, and rule out things that won't ship via Amazon Prime, because I don't feel like paying some massive shipping charge for somebody to send me a TV, okay. And that left only like 4 models, and one of them was a Panasonic, and the Panasonic was the only one that was 1080p.
Because Amazon has terrible television selection, by the way, but I'm not surprised that you narrowed it down to very few models, because they do not they carry every possible brand of, like, you know, I don't know, pen or paper towels or whatever, but like TVs, they do not. Your Best Buy has more selection in terms of models, which surprises me all the time. Like, how can Amazon not have this? But whatever weird math they use to figure out what they carry seems to exclude a lot of models of TV.
Yeah, you would think it would be the opposite because it's Amazon. You know, they don't have a bunch of stores everywhere.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
But yeah, so it was easy. It was, you know, I could choose between some like weird discontinued Sony model or some Samsung thing or some like, you know, Kobe piece of crap or a Panasonic, which I already like, that looks very similar to my current one that had good customer ratings on Amazon and was the only one that was 1080p. I mean, it was a no-brainer. So it was like $550, which I think is pretty cheap for a good TV of that size. So I was like, hey, that's done. the measurements fit perfectly, done. And it arrived today, and it's awesome. Like, I'm really happy with it, and I can't believe how little research I had to do to get a satisfactory purchase here.
Well, like I said, that's why people buy without research, because ignorance is bliss. And if you don't do the research, you don't know what it is you're missing, and you just get what you want. Like I agonized over my small TV purchase because I had exactly the same problem. I quickly discovered that all the small TVs are terrible because they don't make, you know, there's no market for like high-end small TVs. You know, there's more of a market for high-end hatchbacks than there is for small TVs. And so I had to go through all of the models that all had some terrible, you know, fatal flaw that would prevent me from ever wanting to figure out which is the least terrible one. And in the end, the one I chose because it was on sale for like a $200 off what you could find at like a Best Buy type price. And it was on Amazon and it was, you know, prime shippable. And I said, okay, these all have something about them that makes me not able to buy them. But this one is such a steep discount today. I have to get it. So that's what I ended up with. But I'm, you know, I still look at it and I still am sad, but I'm like, well, I did save a lot of money on it. Like mine was around $500 too, but it was a nicer television probably than the one Marco got.
Are you sure? Because the one I have is pretty nice.
Well, I mean, maybe not now because I bought mine years ago. Oh, okay. So, you know, technology marches on, but at the time it was also the highest rated of all the ones I was looking at in terms. And I wish there was a site like DP Review for televisions, but as far as I can tell, there is not. There is AVS forums, which is kind of like DP Review, but exploded into a million pieces. So you have to troll through the forums to figure out what people say. But like, I just want a comprehensive, in-depth technical review of things the way DP Review does cameras.
Yeah.
With image comparisons with comparable models, like the whole nine yards, right? And I could balance that with other stuff. But the only thing I found, like, this is what you should have done this would have just led you to disappointment. But the way my parents wanted to get a television, I just told them to go to CNET's television reviews because they have a nice web interface. They review most televisions. They do a reasonable job. And you can just go, show me the best TVs for, you know, under $500, under this size, with this technology. And it will just show you with the star ratings. And you can, you know, you get a short list of models. And then you go to Amazon and see that Amazon carries none of those models and you'll be sad. But that's you know, that's a good starting point of like, it's kind of like the wire cutter for TVs, but a little bit more comprehensive, because they'll tell me, okay, I want a big TV, I want a small TV, I want LCD, I want plasma, I want LED backlight, I don't care about the backlight. By the way, what is the backlight on yours, Dino Marco?
LED.
Yeah, they're all LED now, but that used to be a big distinguishing characteristic.
And it drives me crazy when people call them LED TVs.
Yeah, I know.
Because that's so misleading.
The magic of marketing. Is yours edge-lit?
You know, I don't even know that.
Yeah, I mean, don't research it. Just be happy with your television. Don't look into it.
I like it, honestly. Like, I think it's great. I mean, I've used it for, you know, an hour earlier today.
Yeah, that's the thing about television technology. Even though all these technologies have some horrible flaw about them, including plasma, progress does march on. I think, you know, people have been talking about the latest crop of Panasonic plasmas. Panasonic is once again making noises about getting out of the plasma business. But they're like, okay, well, if you buy the sort of middle-of-the-road Panasonic plasma that everybody buys, it has better picture than their super-duper top-of-the-line from the last generation.
Oops.
You know? And so that's depressing if you have a television like me. I bought the top-of-the-line, you know, 5 years ago, and now their, like, bargain basement TV probably looks better, but it's heartening in that, like, oh, well, it's finally getting to the point where if you go out and buy a Panasonic plasma today from their current crop of models, you're probably getting a better television than I have for a lot less money. And that's kind of the way technology is supposed to work.
And I think, you know, one reason why I was willing to almost impulse buy a TV is because they're all so good now that, I mean, yeah, they're, you know, within, you can, and especially you, but, you know, you, the general population, can find differences and identify them and nitpick them. But in reality, like, whatever TV you buy chances are you'll be fine with it until it breaks, which is probably, you know, at least 5 years. I know I said on Twitter 10 years. I know I got tons of responses saying that these components do not last that long, and I might expect more like 5 to 7. Okay, fine. But, you know, 5 to 7, okay, 5 to 7 years, that TV is going to work. Like, for me, a TV is a monitor for an Apple TV and an occasional game system. Like, it's not, I'm not asking that much from it. And so I knew that whatever I bought, you know, unless it had some weird thing, like it made a weird noise or like the speakers fell out, you know, barring some kind of catastrophic flaw, almost anything would work just fine for my purposes here.
I still think the distinction between LCD and plasma is significant enough that, you know, like, especially if you're into watching movies, with all the motion compensation stuff, you either leave that on and everything looks weird, or you turn it off and everything looks weird in a slightly different way.
Right.
And like it used to be, I don't know if this is still the case because I haven't researched buying a new TV recently, but it used to be that it was difficult to find, even among the plasmas, you had to be careful to make sure that you got one that could do like true 24 frames per second cadence from a Blu-ray player. Like there's some standards of saying like, oh, put the TV into a mode, because 24 is not a nice multiple of like 60 or 30 or anything like that. And there are various Blu-ray players and TVs conspire to give you the most accurate film-like representation of movies that were shot at 24 frames per second without any weird interpolation, without any image processing delays and stuff like that. And plasmas are still the way to go for that, because the LCDs necessarily have to do some amount of that weird processing stuff, and, you know, the input lag for games and stuff like
right.
that. But, you know, for watching television shows, it's fine. I mean, that's our upstairs bedroom TV is an LCD, and we watch TV shows on it, and the kids watch movies on it, and it's not a big deal.
I will say also, like, I mean, I haven't watched it at night yet, so I'll see, you know, how good the dark detail is, which is one area where plasmas have always really been better than LCDs. But I will say, just looking at the TV in regular daytime usage, you could have told me it was a plasma, and I would have believed it. It really does look that good. Like, LCD has come a long way, and
your eyesight may also be going
right. But no, I mean, like, it really. I mean, and granted, I guess I'm comparing this to what I'm most familiar with, which is a 7-year-old plasma. But my 7-year-old plasma is still pretty good by most standards today, and you know, so it's not like totally. It's not like one of the first generation ones that like. It's all dim and
just turn out all the lights in the room, bring up the beginning of a movie that has a completely black screen with like the director's name and white text in the middle, and then see what that looks like. Does it look like a giant glowing gray square with white light in the middle, or, you know, does it look like a completely black square with white text with a giant halo around it? Or that's where you'll see the black levels, is, you know, when all the lights go out in the room.
Right.
How much light is actually emitted from your supposedly black television screen?
Right, exactly.
You know what's funny is, ask me what kind of TV I have in our family room or living room or whatever you call it.
Is it
a watch TV, right?
I do watch TV. I have no idea what kind of TV it is. I think it's a Toshiba. Really don't know. It was a gift. Don't know. It's funny. TVs are just one of those things I don't care enough. I really just don't care enough. And I'm not saying that you guys are wrong to care. And I kind of wish I cared, but I just really don't care. And for the longest time, we had a 32-inch TV. Above our fireplace, which everyone who comes into our house that actually cares about this stuff says, oh my God, how could you have the TV that high off the ground? You're out of your mind. It's terrible, blah, blah, blah. Don't care. Why don't you have a bigger TV? Don't care. And it's just odd to me what, you know, some people care about and some people don't. And again, I'm not faulting either of you in any capacity for caring. I kind of wish I gave enough of a crap, but I just don't care.
People don't care about retina screens either, which is the
depressing
reality of having taken various family members shopping for iOS devices. I have to take great pains to to show them that there is actually a difference between retina and non-retina iPad screens. They cannot see it. They kind of see it when I show them, but it's like it's the type of thing where if they can't see it just by looking at the screens, what do you then do to show it? So, like, I zoom in on text, or I try to say, do you see the jaggies around the curve of that thing? And, like, you know, everything will be retina. Retina is better. They see that it's better, but it's not like, all right, but is it better enough? How much more does this one cost or whatever? I think that's why, you know, Panasonic's thinking of canning its plasma. This is because, like, plasma has superior picture quality and other characteristics to LCDs, despite all the advances in LCDs. But is it better enough that, and that the other thing that kills me is, like, not only were is the image quality better, but they've been consistently cheaper as well, on the high end especially. Like, if the super high end, you know, LCDs were more expensive for the same size as the plasma, but it's just not better enough. And, like, plasma got, like, bad rep for, you know, heat and power, some of which is true, and burn-in also some of which is true. And it's just like, oh, you know, most people buy kind of the middle-of-the-road LCD televisions, and there's just not enough people who care about image quality to get... I mean, Pioneer got out of the business after their Kuro models, which were, like, the best-looking televisions ever for years and years after they stopped making them. And some people say still had advantages over existing models, so I think it's a little bit nostalgia. But, yeah, like, if your difference is not distinct enough to capture the hearts and minds of people, it's very difficult to make a go of that business. So Panasonic's like, yeah, we are the current king of television image quality, except for, like, I guess those crazy OLED things or whatever. But not enough people care about that difference. They just go and buy LCDs, and we sell LCDs too, and we're just going to get out of this plasma thing, because it, at a certain point, it becomes untenable to be, like, the only person making plasma. Samsung makes plasma too, and other people do as well, but... I've been actually seriously considering buying whatever the very last high-end Panasonic plasma is, even though I did not plan to replace my television anytime soon.
You just got
soon.
It 2 years ago.
It wasn't too. It was a little bit longer than that. But, like, yeah, like I planned to keep it for many, many years, and it's perfectly fine, but I'm like, if I don't get this now, I don't want to be in, like, 5 years or 7 years forced to buy an LCD television. Because I don't think, like, OLEDs or, you know, any other technology will be superior at that point. So, like, I don't want to... It's like letting the Kuro go. Like, you could have bought a Kuro, but you didn't, and then Pioneer stopped making them.
It's like stocking up on old keyboards.
Yeah, no, I have. I have old... I was a big Apple Extended Keyboard 2 user, and so I have a bunch of spares. But then I switched. Like, when the RSI kicked in, I wanted a keyboard with that took less effort to press the keys on, despite the fact that I love the Apple Extended 2, and I used it all the way up through college. So now I have a backlog of Apple Extended 2s, and I guess I will just save them until I can sell them to Gruber for some tremendously high price. He'll come begging one day when he can't find any more.
Yeah, but he's only buying, like, one every 10 years.
Well, maybe he'll just start, maybe they'll start breaking it at a higher rate. So I've got some pretty good condition Apple Extended 2s up in the attic.
Well, that's good to know. I'm glad you brought up the retina thing just very quickly. My parents came down to visit this past weekend, and my dad has a 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, and he was asking me a few questions about it, and so I sat down in front of it, and instantly I was ruined again. And I have, I mentioned in the past, I believe, but I have a 15-inch high-res anti-glare non-retina MacBook Pro. Actually, I have two of them. And my eyes are actually terrible. I have to wear hard contacts because my eyes are so bad. But I was in front of his Retina MacBook Pro for 30 seconds before I was ruined. And I got up and I said, God, that screen's so beautiful. And my mom said, you know, I just don't see it. I don't get it. I believe you, but I don't get it. And so, John, you're dead on about that. It's crazy.
I don't know if, like, do you think that's because, like, all right, so our parents are older and your vision gets worse as you get older. Is that it? Is that just it, though, or is it something else?
I don't think that's it. I think it's a combination of attention to that kind of detail and also just caring about that particular type of thing.
I agree.
Well, and I would like to do, you know, an A/B test where there's some sort of reward, you know, where, like, one of these is retina and one of these isn't. Try to guess correctly. Not that you care whether it's, you know, but can you tell, right? And we can all tell, like, you know, blink tests, put them up on the screen for half a second. But maybe, like, you know, if the same half a second is insufficient for them, if they have 3 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, a minute to stare at them, can they shove their nose up to them? Like, what does it take for you to see it? Because that's separate from, oh, I see, it's a little bit better, but it's not worth it to me, versus I literally cannot tell the difference.
Yeah.
I think, so going back to the 13-inch retina for a sec, so I was in the Apple store today, getting the second Apple TV for this new television that I have previously mentioned. And this was the first time I had seen in person the new 27-inch iMac and even the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, which is, what, like 5 months old now or something?
I think
it's been a while, and I've been busy with, you know, family and baby and winter stuff, so I haven't really had any reason to go into an Apple store and pay any attention to what was there until now. And I think a couple things about this shocked me. One, first of all, the 27-inch iMac, the screen is awesome. It is the first Apple screen. It is the first desktop Apple screen I've seen in years that I would consider owning, because it really is far less reflective than the previous generation of giant 27-inch pieces of glass they've shipped as Cinema displays and iMacs before this. And they're still shipping them as Cinema displays. So, you know, they talked about this new construction that they've had where it's similar to the Retina MacBook Pro, this new construction where they're like gluing the glass or fusing it in a certain way, using like one fewer glass layer than before.
There's no air gap. That's for it. There's an extra, basically, I don't know, some scientific person will tell us, but like, you know, the extra barrier for refraction to take place. So the angle the light changes and changes again, so you get more internal reflection. Right. So it's a big difference.
So, and like the previous generation of 15-inch MacBook Pros before the Retinas, I always hated those glary reflective screens. They were miserable. I owned one for a month and returned it, and then got the anti-glare because it had just become an option. But with the Retina, with that same kind of construction, I think it's fine, and the reflectivity of it has never really been an issue for me. So yeah, I can definitely confirm that the 27-inch iMac has such dramatically reduced reflectivity from the previous one and from the Cinema displays that not only would I buy one if I wanted an iMac, not only would I not hesitate at all about the reflectivity, but if Apple released a Cinema display or, fingers crossed, a Retina display using that same construction, I would buy it in a heartbeat.
Did you? I haven't seen the new iMacs in person yet, but yeah. Did you think that it had the same? Oh my God, the pixels are on the surface of the display look that the Retina MacBook Pros have.
You know, I didn't really get that from it, but I was viewing it at a further distance because it's such a bigger screen. So I'm not really sure that would matter as much at that distance, or at least be as noticeable. But I wasn't looking for that, so I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like that is one of the most startling characteristics of the Retina MacBook Pro screens is. Not so much just the resolution, but that the color appears closer to the surface. That to me is just as startling as the higher resolution. And you know, fusing the glass obviously is going to literally make the color part closer to the surface. I'm just not sure if it maybe the glass is just thinner on the laptops or whatever. But that as they can approach that, I mean, it was kind of the same thing when they fused the glass on the iPhone 4 or whatever it
was.
Yeah,
very similar.
That brought it a little bit closer, but I it's still like the first Retina iPhone did not give me the startling impression that the first Retina MacBook Pro gave me of like the color being on the surface of it looking like some sort of mock-up that someone had made with, you know, with layers of finely laid down paint on the surface of the screen, right. But it's actual pixels.
Yeah, and I also and so speaking of, so I also saw a 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, and I've owned a 15-inch since last summer, so you know it's not like I'm not like totally amazed easily by Retina stuff anymore because I have this awesome laptop, but the 13-inch I looked at it and I thought, you know what, this is a fantastic computer, and you know I picked it up, it was light, it was small. I tried the higher resolution screen modes because one of the problems with the 13-inch screen is that its base mode is a doubled version of only 1280 by 800, which is a pretty terrible screen resolution for space on the screen. You really don't get much space with that. So I bumped it up, and it goes to a simulated 1440 and a simulated 1680. And I found both of them surprisingly usable. And the 1680, that's pretty impressive. Because that's how I run the 15 most of the time.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I did the same thing, and I did it very briefly. And granted, this was based on a sum total of 5 minutes of use. But I thought to myself, geez, I wonder if the high-res mode is livable. And again, my eyes are pretty terrible. I can see my high-res non-Retina MacBook Pro, my 15-inch high-res non-Retina MacBook Pro pretty well. But if you get me more than, I don't know, 2-3 feet away, things are getting blurry and I can't read anything. And so I figured everything would be microscopic, but I had the exact same impression. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say that if I were to buy a computer tomorrow, after that 5-minute experience, what I would really consider doing is getting a 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro and just leaving it cranked up 90% of the time.
It's certainly a very compelling option. And, yep. And you know, and I it struck me as I was there that here I was looking at these two models, the 27-inch iMac and the 13 Retina MacBook Pro, neither of which is particularly new at this point. I mean, the iMac is now 3 months old or four even when it came out December officially. So it's like 4 months old. The Retina MacBook Pro 13 is like 6 months old. You know, these things are not new at all, and yet this was the first time I was seeing them, and I was so blown away by how good both of them were. I really thought, like, similar, you know, I'm more of a 15 inch guy, but that's unusual. Just like I'm more of a Mac Pro guy, and most people like iMacs. And seeing these two computers, thinking that both of them are such awesome choices, that the, I think the 27 inch iMac is by far the best all-in-one desktop I've ever seen in my life. Such a great choice. It's so fast. It's so capable. It's so good, especially with the Fusion Drive. It's so good. And that screen is incredible. Everything's great about it. The 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, very similar. It's so good. It's so fast. It's small. It's light. I would much rather have that than a 13-inch MacBook Air. And I love the 13-inch MacBook Air. And I've owned two of them. But
yeah, the Air screens now are really looking...
Yeah.
Not good. They were never good. Like, the Air screens never had good viewing angle. They never had high contrast. I mean, you know, but what do you want? It's a little skinny MacBook Air, but now they just look, they're just embarrassing.
Yeah. And the weight difference isn't that big between the 13-inch models. Now, yeah, if you want an 11, sure, then your only option is the Air, and that's a very different size. But, you know, here I was looking at these two awesome computers. Very easily could you say that the iMac is the best desktop ever made, and the 13-inch Retina is the best laptop ever made. I mean, those are slightly arguable, but only slightly. You know, these are two very awesome computers, and yet I never even went to see them, which to me 5 years ago would sound insane. And the press mostly glossed over them. You know, they were news for about a day each, and then that was about it. And like, here we are with these awesome, amazing models of Macs, and we don't care. We're saying Apple isn't innovating. And what are they doing for us lately? And we're complaining about iPhones not being big enough or having a new enough skin on the interface and all this crap. And they're making things that even as recently as like 3 or 4 years ago, we would have cared so much more about how great these new Mac models are. And now we barely care at all.
I still care.
Well, yeah, we still care. Yeah. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the press, the public, especially the tech press, which is just a disaster at this point with Apple. But, you know, they're making such amazing things. It's like the Louis C.K., like, everything's amazing and nobody's happy, that bit. Like,
you know, like, on the MacBook Pros, people at work my work is finally buying Macs several years after I brought what I think is the first Mac into the company. And so it's one of the options for people to get, and some people are asking me for advice of which Macs they could buy. It's mostly laptops, right? And it comes down to, like, should I get a MacBook Pro or an Air? And you would think that's a no-brainer, but I've been hesitant to recommend the current generation MacBook Pro Retinas, because that's what they're all looking at. They're not looking at the standard res ones. Mm-hmm. Because of two factors. One is that the GPU can barely handle that screen at the max res, and that will just take care of itself with the next CPU and chipset. We all know,
you
know, the integrated GPUs, right? So, like, that makes me say, okay, that's a first generation thing. You want to be the first guy on your block to have a thing, you get it, but it's not like it's not a deal breaker, but it's like you are at the ragged edge of what that GPU can handle, the integrated one. So that's a reason to wait. And the second one is the guy who used to sit across from me got the 15-inch, and, you know, I saw firsthand the image retention issues that screen had. And I also saw firsthand his frustration at, like, well, if you take it to the Apple Store, they put up the checkerboard pattern for 15 minutes, and if you don't see retention, blah, blah, blah. But, like, I saw it in daily use. Like, you could see his mail window in the background when it was no longer there, and it would happen routinely and in a way that would make me tear my hair out. And so for those two reasons, I figure, you know, we know that the GPU one is going to be solved next gen. So that's a reason to wait. And I hope the next round, maybe they even solved it for the 13-inch, I don't know, but I hope the next round of displays they get will not have this image retention issue. Because Apple does have a policy on it. Like, they have their little checkerboard test, and if your thing fails, they'll give you a new screen. But it's like, it's not a manufacturing defect. It's just the nature of this screen. And I think they've sort of constructed a test that, like, we'll replace the ones that exhibited the worst, but they're all going to exhibit it to some degree. I mean, actually, yeah. Have you seen this, Marco, on your screen? Image retention?
I back when everyone was discovering this, like last summer and fall, I actually made my own little tester for it on a web page anybody can go to, which I forget the URL. How helpful. And it's the same thing. You know, it shows checkerboard and then for like 5 minutes, and then turns off and goes to gray or whatever, and you can see. And so when I run this test on it, I can see the artifact, the retention artifact, but I've never seen them in any kind of regular use.
See,
so I feel like I had like a pretty minor case of it. And so it's not worth it for me to go through the hassle of getting it repaired and going without it.
Well, but the thing is, like, I don't think you would end up with a better screen. In fact, you could possibly end up with a worse one, because I don't think it's, like I said, it's not a manufacturing defect. It's just the way this particular crop of generation of screens is.
Yeah.
And he had the worst, where like the checkerboard wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing seemed to be, I don't know if it was just particular shades of gray or colors or about particular windows that were on screen for a long time, those would stick, and the checkerboards were just faintly visible, but you could like clearly see, you know, the column view of some other window. Like, you know, it's white, pure white and pure black may not be the thing that, that sets it off. I mean, you could see the checkerboard in his too, but like all that makes me think like these are first generation models in so many respects. And if you could possibly wait, like what I told everybody is like, here are the pros and cons. That screen is going to look way better than the Air screen. The Air is going to be way lighter than that 15-inch, you know, thing that you're considering. If you can possibly wait until the next round of pros, your decision might get easier.
The 15 is also way faster.
Yeah.
And supports more true, RAM.
Right. Like this, there are many advantages, but like, it's a toss-up, because I really do, like, my wife's got the 13-inch Air. I really do like the Air, despite the terrible screen. I really do. All the advantages of it, like it's a dead heat between,
oh, yeah,
should I buy Retina or should I buy not. So I feel like I rarely recommend like totally don't buy the first generation, but in many cases it's been true. Like if you had warned somebody off the first generation tie book, that was the right decision. And I feel like warning people off the first generation, at least the 15-inch, I haven't seen the 13, but the first generation 15-inch MacBook Pro, warning people off of that is the right call. At this point, I mean, early adopters, if they want it, they get it, fine. But like, I feel like it's too compromised. Whereas the iMac, I don't think there's any reason to be warned off of that. I feel like it's a next iteration of a mature tech that doesn't have any of these drawbacks, except for that weird looking bulge in the back. And is, you know, all thumbs up. So I'm patiently waiting for the next round, because I'm sure the next round of MacBook Pros is going to be like, oh, that's the one to get. I just hope they solve the screen issue, because I'm particularly sensitive to visual screen issues. Like I remember, yeah, when I got my 22-inch Apple Cinema display, the one with the little clear feet on the side. Do you remember that one?
Yep.
Like the first big one, dead pixels were a big thing on that one. I was like, please let me get a display that doesn't have any dead pixels, or at least let me not see the dead pixels. I hadn't yet honed my ability to not look for them, because that's what you just, I don't want to see them. Just don't tell me. But I immediately saw my like two hot pixels, and they were not within the range that Apple would replace it. And
oh, that
made me sad, because that monitor was really expensive.
That would drive me crazy. I've been very lucky that I've never had a dead pixel in anything that I used actively. So I'm very happy about that. But that, yeah, because that would drive me nuts.
Or a stuck pixel. It's pure white. Just as bad.
But you know, I think I disagree with you about holding off on the current generation retinas. I mean, now, I guess timing wise, you know, these were released last June. Or the 15 was released in June. The 13 was released, what, like in October or something like that. So you know, now we're kind of mid cycle, especially with the 15. It's almost a little late to be buying one now. And I guess, is it the Haswell update this coming summer / fall that's probably going to be that's the next CPU? That's probably going to be when we see the next updates. So Haswell does from the tech news area, Haswell does sound like a pretty major update. And so it's probably going to be worth waiting for if you can. But besides just cycle timing reasons, I don't think there are major reasons why I would recommend against the current generation retinas. I agree with you that the GPU is really, really at its boundary, and that can be occasionally bad, like especially if you run at the upscale resolutions. If you run like on the 15, if you run at the simulated 1920 or the simulated 1680, you know, you will see slow scrolling on certain things and stuff. You know, you will see that. You will.
But
notice
I feel like that's inexcusable, though. Like, you're buying their top of the line model, it should scroll like butter.
Well,
like,
at native resolution, it is butter. I mean, at native resolution, it's great. It's only when you do this the upscale. So I understand. Okay, that's not ideal, but most people are going to run at native resolution anyway. You know, most buyers are not going to change it. So I would not recommend against it solely for that. And so I don't know. I think I would still recommend the Air if you don't care about the screen, which you know most people don't. Because a year ago I was saying the 13-inch Air is the best computer ever made, because it was at the time. and all these options are so good. I mean, they're really there used to be, even as recently as like 3 or 4 years ago, there used to be models in the lineup that you would say, oh, you really, really shouldn't buy that one. And now I feel like you can look at the lineup and there's very few of those. I would say the only ones that I would recommend people definitely don't buy would be the cheapo 13-inch old model, the 13-inch non-Retina MacBook Pro, which, from what I understand, is very popular, or at least was very popular before the Retina one. But I think it still is because it's
got the optical drive.
Right. It has everything. It's cheap. It has an optical drive. It has, you know, FireWire. Like it has all the drives and ports, and it's cheap, and it has spinning disk hard drive, so that keeps it cheap also. So like it's a way to get a bunch of stuff for really very little money. I think it was like $1,200 to start, something like that. So it is very, very cheap. And so it's hard for a lot of people to justify the premiums or the compromises from the other models. However, that model has the worst screen I've ever seen in a laptop in the last 5 years. and the fact that they're still shipping a 13-inch laptop with a 1280 by 800 screen, which is roughly the same pixel area as the 11-inch MacBook Air. It's a similar resolution, but not quite. They're 11 inches wider and shorter, but similar. That's inexcusable to me. And it's just such a terrible resolution. And but other than that, though, they're really, like, you can get pretty much any model and be fine. And even if you get that one and you don't care about the screen space, then you're fine, too. Like, there aren't really any models that have, like, dramatically too little RAM stock or some major flaw, you know, like... The lineup is pretty solid.
I would say the 13-inch non-Retina CD-ROM thing, it's a 5,400 RPM spinning disk at this point is not... Like, I that model is just on the borderline of hurting Apple's reputation, I feel like, because the experience of using that and using even the cheapest Air you can get is like night and day just because of the SSD. Like anything with spinning disks, especially a slow, I'm assuming they're all 5,400 RPM drives.
Probably.
That's not the experience that the rest of us are having with our Macs. And they would be like, they feel like they're left out of, you know, that's not what it's like when we use our computers. You know, you're stuck with waiting a million years and seeing the beach ball and apps take a million years to launch and stuff. And maybe that's acceptable to them, but it's a shame. Like it doesn't give people, because once you step up to that SSD experience, there's no going back. Like, and it really changes. If you were to go back, you say, what's wrong with this computer? Why is that icon bouncing in the dock so much? Why is relaunching Safari and opening its five windows taking a year and a day? Oh, spinning disk. That's why. They don't know. they just know it's no good. So I really hope those things either get SSDs or leave the line ASAP.
But what would you recommend somebody buy if they want a reasonably priced Apple laptop, you know, where value is a priority for them, and also storage space is a priority for them? Because that's the problem with the SSDs, is that there is no way to get cheap, large SSD storage yet.
I feel like the Airs have crossed that threshold, and it was reinforced to me when I had a neighbor come over here, and she had an old laptop. It was like one of the, the old white.
Yeah, the iBook?
Or the
white MacBook.
Yeah, the white MacBook. Yeah. And she was looking to get a new one, and I was telling her about the options, and you can get an Air, and they have SSDs, but they're smaller, and they're more expensive, and blah, 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 and, you know, no optical drive, and the ports, the whole nine yards. And she's like, oh, I don't know, I check the size of all my stuff or whatever. So I actually look at her machine and see how big her iPhoto library is, and it was 9 gigabytes.
So yeah, like, but that's...
This thing, you can get this thing with a 256 gigabyte SSD for not that much money. In fact, is that what's stock now? You're fine. Like, I think we've crossed the threshold where the 13-inch Air is still my go-to Mac, and that's another machine I warn people off. I say don't get the 13-inch non-Retina. Get an Air. Your stuff will fit. You'll be fine. And, like, I mean, obviously I tell them all the limits to how much stuff do you actually have. I'll check, but I'm always amazed at how little stuff people have.
I agree, and it's funny you bring up the SSD is worth a discussion, because I remember, I don't know when it was, but Marco was one of the first people I knew that was going on humongous rants or happy rants and evangelizing SSDs. And I would look at these prices and think, oh my God, that can't be worth it. It can't be that much quicker. It's so little space for so much money. I don't want to do it. So I had and have a 15-inch high-res anti-glare MacBook Pro with a platter in it. And then work got me basically the exact same machine and then immediately put an SSD in it and put the platter in an external enclosure. And now that that's happened, I almost never use my personal machine with a platter drive because it's unusable. It's exactly what you said, John. I can't use it. It's so slow. Nothing happens. If I'm using that computer, really what I'm doing is waiting for the computer and occasionally getting something useful done in the 10 seconds that the hard drive isn't seeking for something else to do. It's unusable. So if there's anyone listening that is as cheap as I am and doesn't think an SSD is worth it, I can assure you you're wrong and you should get one and it will change your world.
People could be in my situation where I do have a lot of data, a lot of computer pack rat type things, you know, where you keep a lot of stuff, you have a lot of movies, a lot of photos, and it just doesn't fit on an SSD. I mean, the first SSD I bought was 480 gigabytes to tell you what my threshold was before SSDs became viable for me. Because forget about 128, 256. No, it's pointless for me to get that. This is all before Fusion Drive, right? But at this point, you know, for my next Mac, all my stuff won't fit on an SSD. And even if Fusion Drive didn't exist, I would still say, okay, for the next Mac, I've just got to go SSD and figure out how to do my own tiered storage thing. But with Fusion Drive, it's a no-brainer. People don't have a choice. The spinning disks are going away. But like we are past the point where even the most conservative person with the most data should have an SSD somewhere in the mix in whatever next machine they're buying. Like we've cleared that hurdle. And for regular people, I think we cleared it much sooner than I had thought, because I guess I just didn't realize how little data people have. Or maybe they delete stuff, or maybe they... I was like, where are all the photos of your kids? I don't know. 9 gigabytes seems small for me with my 100-plus gigabyte iPhoto library of my two kids over the course of 8 years.
Well, keep in mind also, like, a lot of people aren't shooting RAW. They're not shooting
cameras. I don't have a fancy camera. I'm shooting JPEGs from cruddy point-and-shoot cameras. I guess I just take too many.
You had 100 gigs of JPEGs?
Yes.
That's impressive. That's really impressive.
I don't delete enough pictures. I know. I have problems.
On that note, this episode is sponsored. Our first sponsor here in ATP, sponsored by Squarespace, who I love so much because they keep sponsoring all of our shows. Squarespace is a do-it-yourself, easy-to-use web hosting platform where you can post all of John Syracuse's kids' photos if you really want to. You can post your own website. You can make a website for your business. You can make a website for your blog. You can make a store. You can sell stuff, digital or physical. You can make a portfolio. Whatever kind of website you want to make, if you don't want to have to host it yourself and build it yourself and get some designer, go to Squarespace. Plans start at $10 a month. You have so many problems that everyone else has hosting a website, you don't have those problems anymore. You don't have to worry about patching your WordPress install for security updates and getting hacked and all that crap. You don't have to worry about coding all the HTML by hand because they have all these great templates and they're designed by professional designers and you can just pick one of those. Our site, atp.fm, is hosted by Squarespace. You can go take a look. That's one of their default templates. And if you want to hack any of that stuff, you can. You can inject code yourself if you want to customize stuff. You can inject your own CSS and JavaScript. It's really fantastic. So check out Squarespace. If you use coupon code ATP3 for Accidental Tech Podcast, the month of three, so that's ATP3, you can save 10% off their already low-priced plans, which start at about $10 a month. Check out Squarespace at squarespace.com, and thanks to them for supporting our show.
Didn't realize how awesome our sponsor coupon codes would be. It's three letters. I always wonder that people, you know, are going to misspell or mistype neutral or something. ATP.
It's great. It's
right in there.
ATP3.
We got a three-letter domain with a two-letter extension.
That surprised me. I mean, FM is pretty wide open because it's like $80 a year to register one. I'm not that surprised that it was available on FM. But still, it's only three letters. I mean, that is pretty good.
Yeah, it was
like
nice.
We don't even need a link shortener. If people still, I mean, link shorteners I think are like so 2010, but we don't even need that anymore because we have ATP.fm. I mean, that's pretty great. So, all right. One more thing I wanted to mention about my mall trip today before I move on. I also stopped down at the Microsoft store on the way out because, I mean, come on, you have to.
Because you love that place so much.
Because I have to be fair and balanced.
They know you there. Hey, there's Marco. We read what you said about our star.
Fortunately, they didn't recognize me. They did, however, remember how I had the picture of the Windows 8 letters on the floor, and they had to have a guy stationed there to tell people not to step over them? They have fixed that problem now by putting up big, like, floor-to-ceiling glass strips that attach at the floor level to those letters. And so now it's like a big sign. And that was probably always the plan. They just wasn't done in time when I was there. So now they no longer have to have an employee stationed there to tell people not to step over them. So that's, hey, progress. That's, you know, Windows Update. One thing I noticed immediately about the store, first of all, is that it was empty. But that said, I was there on a Wednesday at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I can't really fault them for that. That's not really a high mall traffic time as far as I know. But the mood in the store among the employees, because they were the only ones there, was so low-key. You know, when I was there for the Surface RT launch, which is also, I believe, the store's grand opening or very close to it, the employees were really, like, energized, and you could tell they had all been, like, jazzed up by some training exercise to be all high energy and high pressure and, hey, let me show you this cool thing the Surface RT can do, you know, all that stuff. Today there was none of that. It was like a funeral home in there. There were like eight employees standing around doing nothing. I don't know why the staff is that big. It probably shouldn't be. Although Microsoft is really good at wasting money, so maybe that's just they haven't figured out the retail thing quite yet. But it was way overstaffed. But the salesman came over to me and like the, you know the, I guess the one guy who was assigned to the next walk in as everyone else stood around, he came over and he was just like, "Can I help you with anything?" Like the most bored, like drab, no energy. And I told him, "I'm just looking around." "Okay." And he just like kind of stood. He walked away. You know, it was so different from the last time I was there. And so much less energy. And so I looked around. What I went in there to see was the Surface Pro, because I hadn't seen that in person yet. And I was curious about it. And they don't make it easy to find. The store still had a lot of Surface RTs in like the main middle, like when you first walk in, the tables you see, those still have Surface RTs, but it was way fewer than before because they filled the rest of the store up with Windows phones and other laptops and other people's tablets, things like from Samsung and Toshiba, you know, all their partners, they're filling up the store with their stuff. So the Surface is actually being significantly de-emphasized in the store, which I thought was interesting. Probably the right move because it isn't selling that well, but interesting nonetheless and kind of a shame for them. And the big thing was the Surface Pro, there was no sign for it. There was no big demo of a Surface Pro being this cool laptop that is like a tablet. There was nothing like that. There were two tables side by side of Surface RTs with four tablets on each of them. On one of them, one of those tablets was a Surface Pro. And the only way you could tell was to look at the little like tag on each one to see like a little stand-up sign to see what each one was, and so there was no calling out of, hey, this thing is actually something kind of interesting that you might want to look at or you might want to know about, you know, relative to a regular laptop. Like, this is interesting. Nothing like that at all for the Surface Pro. There was only one of them, as far as I could tell, in the whole store, at least one I could find, and so I thought it was weird that, you know, it looks like Microsoft has already given up on the Surface, honestly. And maybe that's not true, but that's how it looked in the retail store.
Well, the first gen Surface Pro is like a sacrificial lamb, because they know that the first gen Surface Pro, the power envelope is for the processors they can fit in that thing, it's not great. The battery life's not great. It's under, like, that's like to get something out there. The second generation Surface Pro should be significantly more interesting as a complete product rather than just a curiosity.
I hope so. Because, I mean, really, because what the store looked like to me, you know, the first time I went in there, it was very Surface RT heavy, and that was interesting. And I think if the Surface RT was a more successful product, then they could have kept the store that way, and that would have had a lot of long-term value for them. Now, though, the Microsoft store doesn't really have any value over like a Best Buy. Like, it's just a whole bunch of computers from different people all in a row, kind of haphazardly laid out, nothing really called attention to more than the others. So like, if you're a buyer walking in there who doesn't already know what you're looking for, there's not a lot of reason. Like, it's not very welcoming. It isn't a very good, like, cold like first time experience to go in there anymore, because it's kind of confusing as to why exactly you should be in there instead of any other computer store.
It still has far fewer products than a Best Buy, and that is advantageous, because if someone goes into a Best Buy, you are assaulted on all sides by a million flashing, blinking things, only some of which are tablet computers, only some of which are Microsofts, right? You go into the Microsoft store, even though they carry all those other things, you're not going to look at the TVs, you're not going to look at the washing machines, you're not going to look through the racks of DVDs and Blu-rays or whatever, you're not going to... You know, you're going to look at tablets, and there's going to be a variety of them, and they're emphasizing the fact that we have tablets that are kind of like PCs, but kind of like tablets. And so, at the very least, until their leases are up on those stores, like they get some benefit of making people aware that Microsoft has created this product that's like an iPad, but you can use it like a Windows computer. And the recent thing that's brought it up on my radar, I don't know if it's come up on any of your radars, is the guy, Penny Arcade guy, picked up a Surface Pro and tried using it for sketching, and he wrote this little review of it on his site. And that's an application that's like, again, you know, like the car makers, an automatic, not doing what a third party had to do. Why didn't Microsoft emphasize that? Why did their ads show people dancing and clicking the stupid keyboard to the thing? Like, not that artists are like a big market and like, oh, finally we're gonna get the artist thing, but he was interested in it because he heard it has a stylus, and it's a Windows computer, and it's a pressure-sensitive stylus, and it's portable, and you can draw on it. And unlike the iPad, you don't have to use, like, a capacitive, you know, stylus type thing. And so as an artist, he's like, huh, you know, because he tried sketching on the iPad, and it wasn't what he wanted, because he's used to, like, a Wacom tablet or Wacom, or however the hell you pronounce it, the Cintiqs, which is a different experience than using those weird stubby capacitive things, and especially, you know, the pressure sensitivity and everything. So he said, okay, well, I'll try this thing. So you could sketch with it. It was small and portable, right? So some software issues because Photoshop doesn't support it yet with the pressure sensitivity and stuff like that. But it was a viable thing there. He drew a bunch of comics with it. And the second thing was, since he's a gamer, since it's comics about gaming, you can play Windows games on it because it's a Windows computer. And so you install Steam, download a bunch of games, play games, and also use it for sketching. And there has never been any device like that where you could do those two things, or even, you know, one of those things. Can you play PC games on something that's so small, doesn't even have a keyboard, like, you know, just a tiny little touchscreen? And can you use something sketching like a tablet with a stylus? That's an interesting angle. It's not a mainstream angle. They're not going to sell a million of them like that. But why wasn't there even one ad emphasizing that? Because just in this one, you know, semi-famous person's post about this and it getting passed around Reddit and Hacker News and stuff like that, it has produced buzz about the Surface Pro. The terribly compromised, poor battery life, really thick, fan blows hot air on your hand, you know, first generation device that Microsoft couldn't seem to figure out what was interesting or unique about. And here's one thing. I'm sure there are other things that are interesting and unique about it too. It's kind of a shame that Microsoft is not on its game on this.
Yeah, and because you're right, like that's something that Apple is not going to address. That as far as we can tell, they're not going to address pressure sensitive, resistant touch screens anytime soon, if ever. You know, and that's a major market where like that actually matters a lot. If you want to sketch on an iPad, it's going to be way, way better on a Surface because of that screen and the kind of stylus. Obviously, like that's a major difference. And yeah, you're right. They don't know what to do with that. They instead ignore that in their marketing. And granted, you know, obviously not everybody wants to sketch, but I feel like there are enough things about the Surface Pro that make it different from an iPad that Microsoft could be showing in their ads and could be pushing the marketing, and they're just not. They're trying to make it cool and hip. And I can't imagine it ever will be.
Well, they picked one. They picked the attachable keyboard, and that is a distinctive thing. But
there are other
distinctive things about it. And like, it's so they have a product they did so well in differentiating. Like, it really is a differentiated product, not a wannabe iPad. Like, it's not like the Nexus 7 or something. It's like, well, it's like an iPad, but not as good. Like, it's really differentiated. Like, and maybe they did it too much. Like, well, you got a stylus and it runs Windows and it's got the desktop and you can attach a keyboard. Maybe that's too much. But those are sure. Those are things that you can hang your hat on in an ad campaign, and yet they, you know, they picked one of them and kind of they didn't even explain it. They just kind of, oh, it clicks on. There's a clicky thing, and like, I don't know if this is a multi-stage campaign and it's going to kick in with the other benefits later, or they didn't know why people will want to use them.
Still waiting for that second stage to kick in.
Or third or fourth. Yeah. I mean, they have software problems too. Windows 8 is kind of a hodgepodge, and, you know, like it they don't have the total package, but I think there's enough there that I would be really sad if that whole effort of this type of product goes away, because I really think there is definitely a place for this type of product. And I was proud of Microsoft that they didn't do what Google did and just make like a wannabe iPad, you know?
Yeah, they really did do something different. I mean, that's with Windows Phone, people have said that, and with Windows 8 people, I mean, it really is different. It doesn't look like a total ripoff of something else. The way Android does, honestly, and I know we're going to hear from Android people, but no, I mean, Android looks, yes, it has done some original things, but it has ripped off so much from other operating systems, mostly iOS, that you kind of feel that the whole way through, like this is kind of a cheap ripoff. Whereas Windows Phone actually feels dramatically different in most ways, in more certainly more ways than Android does. And there's a lot of good. There's also a lot of bad. I mean, so I want to talk about also. While I was there, they have devoted a lot of their store space now to Windows Phone, which is probably wise, because Windows Phone has a pretty poor retail presence otherwise outside of Microsoft stores. And that's always a problem. Like, if you go into a Verizon store and you ask to see a Windows Phone, they're going to try to talk you out of it, and they're going to try to talk you into an Android phone. Like, that's because, you know, it's better for Verizon if you buy an Android phone for a few reasons. So Windows has always had issues at cell phone retail with Windows 8. And so now, Microsoft has had issues, not Windows, sorry. So Microsoft is using their stores now to push Windows Phone aggressively, and that's wise. So I got a chance to use them and look at them. And first of all, I think it's worth mentioning that every Windows Phone they had in the store had at least what looked like a 4.5-inch diagonal screen. It was huge. Every Windows Phone looked massive. And most of them were the Nokia 920. And there were a few. There was like the HTC 8 or something like that. Or I don't know. People who know Windows phones would know these models. And there were some Samsung things and some miscellaneous Windows phone objects. And mostly the Nokia one, though. And all of them were huge. And I feel like, you know, in our previous discussions about a potentially large iPhone in the future, I feel like more than ever, Apple needs to do this, because you look at any other lineup of smartphones in any other store, in a Verizon store, in a Microsoft store, if you can actually find one of those, but you know, any cell phone store, you look at the lineup and the iPhone looks really small, and not necessarily in a good way. It looks really small by comparison. And you know, while we can look at them, we nerds, a lot of times at least, we can look at them and say, oh, it's great, it fits my pocket better. You know, I don't want a phone that big. The fact is, those other phones look like they're better in a store. And it's similar, you know, we talked about TVs earlier. To have TVs, as John, you've frequently ranted about, they always have these ridiculous settings in the stores to attract people in the store, even though in real life they're better off not having that kind of setting, and they're better off having something else, or different priorities, or different, you know, different levels of things. That doesn't matter in sales. You know, like if people are seeing all these phones that are a little bit too big for their pockets, they don't really realize that necessarily at the time they're buying it. They see a nice big screen and it looks really good. And it's got to be really hard for Apple to keep competing with when it's the smallest phone there, and it has the smallest screen there. That there are going to be some people who are going to buy it for that because it's small and sleek and thin and light in your pocket. But I feel like that number is really small compared to the number of people who are going to be swayed towards these larger phone devices just because they look nicer in the store.
I really, to be honest, I don't have anything to add on that, because I just don't have any interest in a bigger phone. And well, maybe
get used to
ask
it.
Me again. I know. And that's the thing is, anytime I say I don't have interest in something, I end up getting it months or years later.
I mean, you're going to get it. Like, you may have no interest in it, but if all the phones are like that, what choice do you have? Like, that's just what happens.
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, and typically the more negative my reaction is to something, the more I end up falling in love with it later. Take Macs, take my iPhone, take my BMW. I mean, these are all things that I poo-pooed in years past and now couldn't imagine living without.
SSD.
So my SSD, another great example. So the fact that I'm saying meh is probably a good sign that in a few months, or, you know, because I am due to upgrade this year, so in a few months when the 7-inch iPhone comes out and I'm forced to get it because it's the only one, and then I get it and I say to you guys, holy God, you will not believe how awesome the 7-inch iPhone is. I can't put it in my pocket. It looks like a brick when I'm actually talking on the phone, but oh man, I can get so much done on that screen.
It's not going to be as big as the 920. So don't worry.
Well, I mean, the 920 looked ridiculously large, but it looked nice.
You can fend off muggers with
it. In a store, it looked nice. and I picked it up, and I held it in my hand, you know, with the giant security cable hanging off the back. But still, you know, I picked it up, and I was like, you know, this is, you know, this, it's too big for me, but not by a massive amount. Like, it could be a little bit smaller than that and still be substantially larger than the iPhone 5, and it would be fine for my pocket. And, you know, a lot of us in tech, you know, we'll say dismissive things like, oh, well, you know, I don't want an iMac. I want a Mac Pro. But for other people, the iMac is fine. You know, it's always about the other people. And it's generally not a great attitude to have if you don't really understand, you know, what about something is great, and you kind of dismiss it as, oh, well, somebody will find a use for this. But with the bigger phones, I think, honestly, I would probably get a bigger iPhone if they had it. Like, I like the bigger screen on the iPhone 5. And if they could make one even bigger than that, while still maintaining a reasonable pocket size for the phone. And I do think there's a lot of middle ground between the iPhone 5 and the 920. Like, there's a lot of middle ground there. And if Apple made a bigger phone, I'm not just saying that I think it would sell well. I'm saying I might pick that one, even if it had the same resolution as the iPhone 5 and they just made the pixels bigger. Even then, I would still probably pick the bigger one.
I've been asking nerd friends that same question. I've been saying, so Apple comes out with a slightly bigger phone, and they keep selling the iPhone 5 size one, which one would you get? And then, like, the modifier question is, okay, what if the resolution is the same? What if the resolution is different? Does that change your calculus? And I've been getting about 50-50 with people saying that they would stick with the iPhone 5 size and they would get the bigger one. You don't know what people are actually going to do. And I think at this point, the super Apple nerds that I'm talking to are, if anything, biased towards sticking with the iPhone 5 they have because they really like it, and I'm giving them a hypothetical of a product that doesn't exist. But I think the outlook for sales of the larger phone, even among us super tech nerds, look pretty bright.
Yeah, definitely. I would say the same thing. I mean, I haven't been asking anybody because I'm not that much of a nerd, John. But I really do think, you know, I can see, not only do I see this as, I guess somebody might want that, but I see this as, I would actually want that to a degree. You know, it depends on how they do it, of course. But, you know, I don't think it being the same resolution or not would really matter that much. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think it really matters. It would matter
I think it definitely matters, but it's not a deal breaker, I don't think. But it's one of those things where it's going to be one of those that can't go back things where it's annoying. You're going to hate it because you're going to have to redo your layouts for your apps and everything. But then once you get that thing and see how much more stuff you can see, even if it's just like one extra little sliver of stuff, it will make a difference once developers update their apps to actually use that space, as long as they don't stretch it. And then you go back to it's like when you go back to the iPhone 4 size screen now or 4 and you feel like, where'd the rest of the screen go? And it's not that big of a difference. It's like a 1 centimeter little strip at the bottom.
It's one,
like,
table row.
It is not that big of a difference. But when it's not there, it just feels like your world has been truncated. And, you know, so I think it will be the same effect. Even if we just get an extra sliver of pixels there, you know, I mean, maybe 1080p is the inevitable. There's no fighting that resolution because it's such a convenient matchup with television screens, which is basically meaningless. Who cares if it's a matchup with TV screens? But just, it's like one of those things of like stock markets and round numbers. It may just be that's ballpark of how you get a reasonable size iPhone. It's not gigantic, but not too small. And you get around, you know, 400 something DPI. Can you fit a 1080? Well, just go to 1080. I don't think Apple will go to 1080p, but like, that's what all the Android phones are doing. And you can see the attraction to it. Like, that slots into maybe a little bit higher. Maybe you have to go like 500 DPI. Maybe that's crazy. Maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't work out. But that seems to be the sweet spot for the super high-end Android phones. Apple's going to be smaller than that, and maybe not even this generation. But that's where I think things are going.
Well, I don't think the resolution of these Android phones matters that much, honestly, because as we said earlier, people don't really see Retina that much. Like, on average, most people don't really notice that difference, as far as we can tell, or at least a lot of people don't. I think whether your screen is 300 dpi or 500 dpi, there's going to be almost nobody who will tell the difference. The big advantage there is definitely, you know, in marketing and spec comparison and things like that. Certainly that helps. But with Android, as we're seeing with the market, most people don't buy on spec comparisons with Android. They buy on how it looks in the store, what kind of deal they can get at retail. You know, there are some people who buy the specs, but not most.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're still using, you know, a lot of them are using the OLED screen still, some of them are still, I think people still using that Pentile thing where you don't even have real pixels.
Oh, I hope not. That was a terrible hack.
Right, like, all these things are cost-saving things, because that's the other advantage they have, is, like, they'll compete on price by giving you a lower quality screen. And that is, talk about selling against Retina, how hard it is to sell Retina to regular people. Trying to sell people on, like, color saturation and contrast and viewing angles, that is, you know, and we nerds all appreciate that Apple cares about those things in its displays and its monitors and its, you know, handheld devices. Other people do not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so, like, I hope Apple holds the line on that, but that's one of the boat anchors that they have to drag behind them as they attempt to compete, is we will continue to hold our screens, like, I mean, that's, you know, our screens aren't bigger, but they're better. That's why they keep saying this is the best screen and blah, blah, blah. And, like, it really is a really nice screen. But now you have to drag that behind you as you try to compete on price, on power, on resolution, on all those other things that you want to compete on, while still not sinking to their level in terms of, well, just give me high DPI, high resolution, and it's good enough.
All right, so I had a topic I wanted to ask you guys about, if neither of you have something more.
Go for it.
Pressing. I'm actually, it may end up that this is a 30-second thing, but I'm really intrigued by the GarageBand release today and its support for, what is
Audio
it?
Bus.
Audio Bus, yeah. I believe. Yeah. So for those of you who may not know what this is about, so Apple obviously has a GarageBand app for iOS, and a few months ago, I don't remember exactly when, some group of people came up with this app called Audio Bus, and the general premise of it was you can chain audio sources together such that different apps on your iPad or iPhone, one can feed audio into another, which can filter it and can feed audio into something else, or at least that's my understanding of the premise. And this was really interesting because it's inter-app communication in a way that really shouldn't be allowed. And I think my understanding, and guys, feel free to interrupt me, my understanding of how this works is it's a combination of background audio API, the apps allowing audio to be mixed. So if you think about, like, when you have navigation on, and music on, you know, you can still hear the navigation while the music is on. And additionally, apparently it's a local network protocol as well, as far as I understood. Is that at least reasonably accurate at a high level?
Honestly, I don't even know how they're doing. I mean, I assume background audio is involved to let them run indefinitely. But I mean, they're not using URL schemes, that's for sure. So
actually, I think they are in part, but not
to
as
transfer
the
audio.
Driving. Correct, right. So anyway, so the latest version of GarageBand actually works with AudioBus and has included, and they use the AudioBus SDK to do it. And this to me is extremely interesting because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's Apple getting on board with a community, or maybe not community, but a third-party framework, for lack of a better term. And I think that's very interesting. And I'm hoping that between you guys, you can point me to other examples of where this has happened. The only one I could think of is their kind of bastardized version of Pull to Refresh. But otherwise, I couldn't personally think of any examples of this. And I'll give you a chance in a second to correct me. And I thought that was interesting. But the other thing I thought was interesting is here's another sort of tacit admission that inter-process communication is a need in iOS, and it's something they need and something that we are all going to want going forward. And I know we've talked in the past about, what was it, remote view controllers, I believe, is what people had discovered a few months ago in iOS 6. And this both excites me in the sense that Apple's getting more on board with inter-process communication, but it also scares me a little that it seems to me if they had a really awesome fix for this problem coming in iOS 7, wouldn't they have held this GarageBand update to leverage that new thing?
No, I don't think they would have held it. Because I think it's something entirely different. But actually, I had an interesting idea when hearing you talk about this, and I did a little bit of research on it before the show. But I don't know if any of you have ever seen this, but apparently there exist, I am told, stereo equipment, I guess presumably high-end stereo equipment, that has firmware. And to update the firmware on the stereo equipment, you put in a special CD that the manufacturer gives you, and you play the audio CD, and then it interprets the sounds as, you know, code that's going to update the firmware, update itself. So,
like a modem?
That's not dangerous.
This audio bus thing.
Yeah, seriously.
We don't have true inter-app communication. But once everyone can listen on the audio bus, if you can encode the data that you want to transfer between applications as audio and decode it on the other end, there is no reason why you can't pass arbitrary structures, including, you know, in-memory objects or anything else you could possibly want to do for inter-app communication entirely through audio, provided you could mute the speakers for it. And I'm sure Apple would love to try to approve your application if you choose to do inter-app communication with this. Yeah. Now, the reason I don't think it's like they've held this is because this is not really inter-app communication. This is really shared access to like audio resources. It's more like I/O or like multiple applications sharing like the proximity sensor. Like once sound goes out of your application into the audio system, the fact that another application can pick up that sound, intercept it, and before it gets through the rest of the audio system using, you know, the background audio APIs and stuff, that is barely inter-application communication. Existing background APIs where some small part of your application can still be running and see what's going on in the system. And one of the things that's going on in the system is another thing's putting audio input into the audio subsystem, and we'll let you get it before it goes out the speaker, you know what I mean? But that is a far cry from, hey, let me put up a UI when I'm not running.
Casey, you said that you looked at it briefly, and it sounds like the way it works is via local network communication, right? It isn't over audio buses itself. Isn't it over local network? Is that what you said?
Again, I read into it very briefly, and candidly, I'm probably getting this totally wrong. And that's why this is also a casual podcast. but I believe that somebody had said that there was a network component. I'll have to see if I can get this link.
All right, I'm going to start talking. So, look it up. So I think there's three things about this that are really interesting, that make this announcement interesting. One is that it's technically possible at all with iOS today. You know, because the problem with iOS, you can do anything you want in an app running in the background for 10 minutes, and then you hit your time limit, and then you're killed or suspended. So
you'll be killed way before then if someone launches a game anyway.
That's true, right? So you know, and when Apple introduced multitasking with iOS 4, they announced these like, you know, five or six, you know, officially sanctioned and technically allowed methods to keep running in the background indefinitely or be woken up periodically. And one of those is background audio. And so it's kind of a fluke that, okay, so we have a need for apps to work together for more than 10 minutes in the audio business. That's just, they just kind of lucked out that audio happens to be one of the permitted things on iOS to run for longer than that. And then the other thing that makes it impressive is that it's technically possible at all to share a substantial amount of data between apps without switching back and forth URL schemes, which themselves would have issues with lots and lots of data flowing through them. So, Casey, do you know yet whether it's shared core audio buses or network communication?
So, sort of. Let me read you a couple of very brief things. The first, which is less reliable, is a post on Stack Overflow, which is the accepted answer to the question of basically how does this work?
Well, then it's
and
true.
It's, well, right. And I'm quoting now, my guess is that they use some sort of audio over network because I've seen log statements when our app gets started, even on a different device. Don't really know about the details of the implementation, but this could be a way of staying in the sandbox constraint.
Because I don't know. Basically, with core audio, I know a little bit about core audio. And as far as I know, I don't think you can create any kind of shared communication between apps using the audio frameworks on iOS, because right. You'd have to like create a virtual device. It wouldn't be an issue of being piped through the speaker. It would be an issue of you even having access to any other apps created audio devices, and then So if it's not core audio based, which it probably isn't, if it is based on local networking, then that's interesting too, because I don't think people have really, besides this, I don't think people have really explored inter-app communication potential of just opening up a local web server or a local socket and communicating over a local host to some other app. I don't think we've really ever discussed that. And I would never have assumed that would even be possible. Like I would have assumed there was some kind of like per app firewall going on there, but I guess there probably isn't. I mean, that would probably be pretty hard to do, and there would probably be some problems with it. So maybe there isn't any kind of protection against local network communication between apps.
All right, so let me read you a couple of other very brief things. On the same Stack Overflow post, this is a comment now to a different answer. This is Sebastian Dittman. I'm part of the AudioBus team. We developed our own SDK for this, and as has been mentioned before, it's basically a network protocol. And then let me go to the AudioBus developer docs, and it says, blah, 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 blah. This process involves setting up your project, enabling background audio, creating a launch URL and registering your app, making sure audio session mixing is enabled, which is where we were talking earlier, John was talking earlier about having everyone on the same audio bus, getting access to your app's audio unit. Candidly, I'm not really sure what that means. And then creating instances of the audio bus controller, input and or output ports, and the audio unit wrapper from your app delegate. Easy peasy. That's what it says.
Okay, so it's using core audio in the audio unit, but then it's taking the inputs and outputs of it and basically pulling them out of the core audio framework.
It's a side channel. And, it's like the audio unit is probably there just so it can, oh, you want the samples? Here they are. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to take them. It's like it's teeing them off into whatever it's, its network thing.
So it is definitely working over network, than it sounds like, because I don't think they would do any kind of core audio. I don't think they can do any kind of core audio thing. So anyway, there's three things about this that I think are really interesting. There's the fact that it's technically possible at all, which, okay, we got that. The second is that it's been permitted so far in the App Store, that Apple hasn't removed these apps from the store, told them they can't do this anymore, rejected them outright. I mean, that is very interesting that Apple has kind of looked the other way on this, because you could argue that it's probably misuse of the background audio API, because each one of those apps, like the background audio API, is made for or is intended for one app to be playing something you're listening to, like Pandora, or or a podcast app. Like that's what these are for, is something that's playing a continuous audio thing that is not the built-in music app. You know, that's what it's for. So the fact that you have like multiple apps all doing background audio working together to make one combined stream to pipe into something else, that is clearly against the spirit of what this is for. So it is surprising that Apple allows it. And now the third interesting part about this is that not only is it technically possible and they've permitted it so far, but now somebody on the GarageBand team actually got them to let them add support for it in GarageBand. So it's kind of an implied endorsement of this method. And granted, you know, exactly. Apple is a company with more than one person, so it's possible this was like, you know, one thing that slipped through that like doesn't really fit with the overall strategy of iOS, but this one person on this one team was allowed to add it, nobody noticed. You know, it's possible but it also is possible that they want to encourage this. And part of it, you know, Apple has always culturally, especially with Steve Jobs, they have a soft spot for music and musicians. And you know, that's why GarageBand was one of the first major iPad apps they made that launched with the iPad 2, and they were so proud. Like, you know, music is great, and you know it's in our culture, it's well respected. People love musicians, you know, and it's very fulfilling to a lot of people in a very basic way. Like, it's really hard to explain, but you know, it's music is very powerful, and so Apple's always had a soft spot for it. So maybe this is Apple just kind of saying, okay, you know, we'll let this happen for this group of musicians and music people who are making these things because we like music a lot, and that's fine. Because I can't imagine. Also, I guess another reason they would allow this would be that if they do something in iOS 7 or in any future iOS, something involving inter-app communication that's better, something like sharing with contracts or intents like Android and Windows Phone 7 or Windows Metro, whatever. If they do something like that, I don't see anything like that being able to replace this. You know, like the way they would architect something like that probably couldn't be a stream of constant high bandwidth network communication, high bandwidth, low latency with a bunch of apps hanging out in the background. I can't see that happening.
Well, it's not that high bandwidth. It's actually low bandwidth. I think that's why they get away with it. I think it all comes down to this being audio, and not so much in the musical sense of how they want to do that. Although there's part of that. I think they want to encourage the ecosystem of applications that cooperate and make, you know, it a more interesting musical device. But because perhaps they're wrong about this, and they'll find out and have a harsh lesson. But it's not, you're not reaching into someone else's application root directory and screwing with it. You are not calling into another application and executing arbitrary code. Audio is seen as inert. It cannot cause arbitrary, as far as they know, it cannot cause arbitrary execution of code elsewhere. It doesn't do any of the things that they want to keep people separated for. And they already have an API that lets you do audio stuff in the background. This is audio stuff. It seems safe. It's not a security thing. Presumably that no one is actually crazy enough to do the thing I was joking about before, but actually encoding all of your inter-application communication as an audio stream, because that would be crazy, but I think it would be awesome. So anyone out there wants to try that, I give you a thumbs up. And like you said, so they come out with something different. They would still keep this. I think the most interesting thing about it is they didn't do the Apple thing, which is, so there's these audio bus guys out there and they have this idea. Either buy them or make something of our own that's exactly like it and, you know, crush them. Maybe Audiobus got out front. Maybe they are planning to buy them. Maybe waiting for the other shoe to drop. But it could. I mean, this is so weird for the modern Apple. It's like we totally expect them to either buy the company just to get the employees, buy the protocol, or just simply say, "Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Can we do that? Yeah, do that." And then just do something that's does the exact same thing, possibly a little better, possibly a little worse, but completely in house. I mean, maybe this got out in front of them. I'm not in the music scene, but it could be that, you know, Audiobus looked like it was getting traction among people developing applications, and Apple just wanted to join in. But it's like I like that activity of them looking into the third-party market, seeing someone who's come up with something, and not just attempting to buy them outright, not attempting to crush them with their own implementation, you know, dashboard style or whatever, but just say, all right, well, you guys are going with that. We'll join into your thing, because it makes the iOS devices more compelling for people who are interested in music to have this ecosystem. Like, you know, as if it wasn't compelling enough to have all these great music apps, now they can cooperate with each other. They could be the first people to get the benefit of what we've all been talking about of, like, geez, if you could just get rid of these silos that are separating it, the iPad could become a much more useful device. Maybe they're the first people out of the gate who are able to do that, the musicians.
So I have a hypothetical question for you guys. In hearing, John, you talk about encoding everything as audio, and I know you say that kind of jokingly, and I also know you say it kind of seriously.
I still maintain that's probably not possible to transfer between apps, but go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. So let me take you on a meandering journey that hopefully will end up at a decent point. When PasteBot came out, which was, to my knowledge, the first TapBots app that really people started paying attention to, and maybe that was their first app, I don't recall. But I believe it was PasteBot that tried to run silence in the background in order to stay in open and in sync constantly, because, you know, obviously there's only a couple reasons you can background your app for more than 10 minutes. So they thought, oh, we'll just play silence forever, use this audio mixing, not unlike Audiobus, so you can still hear other things at the same time. And Apple ended up saying, nice try, but that ain't happening. So you can't leave an app running constantly. And so, Marco, this also was cued by what you said a moment ago. And so I wonder if it would be possible to do something like have your app have some sort of server component just locally. And so let's say you wanted to transfer an 80 meg file between two apps, whatever that may be. It doesn't matter. So what if app one says, hey, I'm about to background this task, and starts up a server locally on the phone or the iPad or whatever, does a URL scheme into some other app that it's aware of, you know, like an X callback URL or something along those lines. And that second app, app two, then gets onto app one's server component or whatever you'd like to call it, downloads that thing, that 80 meg file in the span of under 10 minutes, because why wouldn't it? It's all on the same device. And then suddenly you have a way of doing file transfer between apps as long as it takes less than 10 minutes. Does that even make sense? Would that
it
theoretically
does.
Work?
I mean, I think these are all such ridiculous hacks that I think it would be more wise unless you had a really pressing need to make an app that did this kind of stuff right now, I think it would be more wise to just kind of wait and see what iOS does to address this. And, you know, because obviously, I think with forestall being out now, it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing major new directions with iOS. We probably won't see it with iOS 7 because it's just too soon since he's been out. But you know, I think we can look at Apple under Tim Cook, and we can see things are being shaken up gradually. You know, it's not like totally transformed overnight to a different company, but things are being shaken up, and we're seeing like things that were previously very attributable to Steve Jobs, which had a lot of overlap with things that were attributable to Scott Forstall, because Forstall was very much like kind of made himself in Jobs' image, or even vice versa. I don't really know, but things like everything being so strictly sandboxed and so strictly separated, it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing relaxation of that as the platform matures, as competition gets more strong and addresses all those areas way more robustly than Apple does. I think we'll start seeing development here. And so, you know, you mentioned remote view controllers and iOS 6 being behind the scenes for a few things. That is something to watch. And if we, if you think about how Apple would implement something like remote view controllers for general purpose use, an app would kind of have to have like a low power state where it's in the background, it's not rendering an interface. Ideally, if you only have to like load up a sharing sheet for your app or something, and then it goes away, and your app was never launched recently. Ideally, it could only load like a small amount of the app, and not even instantiate the whole view hierarchy, even if it's not being displayed. Like, ideally, your app would have some kind of like fast loading, low needs mode, where it could interact with other apps like this, and iOS could still maintain its, you know, great battery life and only loading apps when they're needed to be loaded and suspending them for all their times. Like, I feel like there are a lot of technical, like hairy details about that, about how you would do that from a developer point of view, from an architecture point of view. You know, there's a lot of ways to do it that would suck in some major way for somebody, whether it's the developer or whether it's iOS or the user. But I feel like that area, the entire tech world has been pressuring Apple so hard, especially this past year, to address that particular area. And the remote view controller thing and UI activity looks like baby steps towards something better there, that I feel like investing any kind of major time or effort or development or product, investing heavily into the old ways that you can do things right now is probably bad timing. Because iOS 7 is going to be announced in a few months in all likelihood, probably at WWDC. And I feel like we are right on the verge of a change that is very likely to affect this particular area of iOS dramatically. So I wouldn't put much into it right now. That's the short, the very long way of saying that is what I just said. The short version is, I don't think it's the right time to invest heavily in weird workarounds for iOS's lack of good inter-app communication.
No, but it would definitely be cool. I mean, I was joking. Like, it's a silly thing to do, but but if someone did that, that would be a story that would get passed around, because it's you know, it's a hack. It's interesting and it's novel, and I'm sure we could find some sort of technology or protocol for perhaps modulating and demodulating audio to transfer data. I don't know. I'm just
sure. I mean, you could just like do like one bit per sample, where you just move, you know, have like a sample of one to zero to negative one to zero. Like, you know, you can modulate into just a very, very tiny waveform that is so small that you would not hear it on any kind of speakers or headphones that you would have put into an iPhone, and you know, encode the data that way. I
mean, well, that's the question, is if you can mute it or not, like during,
that's the problem,
the,
yeah,
thing. Like I was trying to think of like who would, given like the ridiculousness of this, and you know, why shouldn't you just wait for iOS 7, who would actually have the resources and poor judgment to attempt something like this? And the only people I could think of have no reason to do it, because they already have server-side components, and those would be like the Zyngas of the world. They would use it as a backdoor to like share information between their annoying applications, but they don't need to do that because they've got a server and they'll just talk, they do what they do now and transfer all your information to the server. So when you launch another game by the same manufacturer, they know all about what you played here and can promote this game or buy this, you know, so they don't need this. Like, their inter-application communication for that crowd is called a server. And that's, I mean, it works that way for a lot of people too. Like, what we really want it for is like, God, stop stranding my stupid text documents in the umpteen text editors I have. You know, that's what we all want. And, you know, in those cases, you know, it's not because you want, you know, three games from the same maker to be able to know about each other and know about your scores and activities. I want documents created in applications not made by the same vendor to not be in these stupid silos. And that's what we're all waiting for. It's like, you know, popping up UIs is one thing, and the other thing is the file system or whatever. And, you know, maybe iCloud is the solution to that, but not really, because they're still siloing that off as well. So that's what I think we're looking for in, you know, inter-app communication is shared UIs type of thing, loadable bundles with UIs that you can put in where your application isn't really running, but some code that's part of your application is running, and some solution to how can we use multiple applications to work on the same project, you know, with file, multiple applications from different vendors. I mean, the audio bus is almost not the really solution. That's more like a bunch of guitar pedals that you hook up in sequence to a layer effects on. But like, I feel like it's the same type of thing. What if you want to do audio creation and you have audio bus and you'd be like, geez, I wish I could use these seven apps to collaborate to create this. Instead, one kind of has to be the master app that actually gets to record the resulting audio, and then everything else is just a bunch of effects boxes and pedals that you're putting in a chain to modify things. So they're creeping up on it, but you know, they still have a long way to go. And as for your speculation about the forestall jobs thing, like, do you have any actual information about, like, everyone likes to attribute to whatever thing they don't like, now that forestall's gone, it will stop happening and the good thing will happen. And like, I don't know if he's the one who was insisting on silos. He's like, why is his departure make you think that this good thing that we want will now finally happen? Like, as if he was the barrier to it. I don't, and maybe you have information I don't, but I have no information about it. And I don't see that. Like, I mean, it's conceivable, but I, without any actual connection to information, I'm saying like, oh yeah, forestall was totally, and because I have heard some things about things that he was gung ho for that I disagree with, but this was not among them. But you know, I'm hesitant to pin my hopes on on the magic departure of Scott Forstall.
Yeah, you're probably right about that, honestly. I mean, I don't have any information to support that either. It was just a hunch. It's probably wrong. Who knows?
I mean, like, we know they need this anyway, but like, they need lots of things, and they tend, you know, they'll get there eventually.
This is going to be the year of desktop Linux.
Yeah. Well, no, we actually do get it eventually, though. We got copy.
That's true.
We got Notification Center, such as it is, eventually.
Yeah, it's funny because as you guys were talking, I was thinking back, you know, well, and, you know, you said, well, one thing we want is to be able to pop up a view or some sort of view controller in another app from within my own app. And it occurred to me that when I was, you know, spitballing about transferring this Phantom 80 meg file, well, we can already do that. The thing is, we can't do it locally. We do it via Dropbox. And so I kind of wonder if, in addition to being able to throw up something small in somebody else's app, I wonder if really what I've been asking for this entire show is just Dropbox, but local, you know, something that serves the same purpose that Dropbox does today.
It's called the file system, Casey, and they don't want you touching it. Stay in your little sandbox.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, that iCloud does not address that at all.
They chose to silo it. I mean, you know, it's no reason iCloud couldn't work exactly like Dropbox, except that Apple doesn't want it to. And so it doesn't.
I think history will show that that particular detail of iCloud is a big mistake. I think if you look at something like the photo library on iOS, that's a really good example of how to do something like this better. Certainly it's not perfect, but you know, there's a lot of apps that can interact with the same photo library, and it's, you know, it's fine. I mean, yeah, again, it could be better, but it's way better than if you have some other type of document or some other type of data that you want multiple apps to be able to interact with. There's just no good option for that, except Dropbox, which, you know, obviously that's not great for Apple. I really do think, like, if iCloud could be broadened to basically have different containers for any given MIME type, say, Or any given set of mime types.
Like,
I mean,
just,
I know
you're just bargaining now because it's like, well, I'm working on a project that has some images and some text documents and some audio and some movies, and now they're in silos by type. Like, I mean, there's a reason that the file systems exist the way it does. It's because it's like you can't predict ahead of time what would you call it? What facet you're going to use to organize things? What is the word I'm looking for? What axis or whatever?
Right.
How are you going to categorize things? Is it by type? Is it by date? Is it by like, oh, well, if you just make a file system, you can do all of those things. And we also have another thing, which is like a hierarchy with like by location, by path. And
I mean, it could be by project. You know, I have photos that I have to work with for the magazine that are not in my photo library for myself because they're not my personal photos. There's all sorts of, everyone has these kind of exceptions
to
everything.
And inside the project folder, maybe you'll divide it up by type underneath the project folder, or maybe you'll divide it up by a secondary category and then by type. But like, I think the decision not to have a real file system in iCloud is the right one. They just like that. I admire them for sticking with it. I hope they don't cave because they could implement Dropbox. They could have implemented Dropbox a long time ago, but they didn't because they said, yeah, we understand that. Yeah, just give us a shared hierarchy file system that's on the network that syncs everywhere. Dropbox does that. Apple could do that. They've chosen not to because they know like how untenable the file system is for human beings, period, like non-nerd people. And so they're holding the line and saying, no, we are not going to give you an arbitrary hierarchy that you can enforce the way you want because people have proven they can't make that work. And they just haven't figured out a workable alternative yet. But I'm proud of them for not caving and not saying, well, you know, iCloud documents in the cloud? Well, now it's just an arbitrary file system, just like Dropbox, and go nuts. Like, because everyone would cheer that and be like, yay, this is great. Apple's finally, you know, done what we wanted. But I'm totally convinced that people in general cannot grok that concept. And it's not a question of education and time, because now we're several generations into the computer age. It's not something that people grasp. It's something that we have no problem with and subset of geeks have no problem with. But, the simpler things, like you talk about the photo sharing, people can kind of grasp that. People can kind of grasp the stupid limited silos that we all hate. There's got to be something that doesn't expose the full file system that gives us some of the benefits, and you know, Apple hasn't found it yet, and I feel bad for them, and I feel bad for us, but I am proud of them for not making Dropbox. I'll be proud of them right up to the point where my frustration just overflows, and you know, as long as Dropbox is still around for the nerds, that also kind of mitigates this right. thing. It's like, okay, well, you keep working on that, Apple, but in the meantime, you know, all the nerds are just using Dropbox to get their work
done. I kind of feel like the, obviously there's been a lot of discussion in the last few years about moving away from exposing the file system to users. And I feel like it's one of those simplifications that the problem is way more complicated than that simple solution can properly address. And that, you know, the reason why files have lasted as long as they have as the metaphor for storage management for people is that this is a complicated problem, and files are a very simple and extremely powerful way to address it at the cost of user complexity, especially for people who just don't think that way or who are so new to it, they need time to adjust. And we see, obviously, we see so many failures of like, quote, normal people or people who are really new to computers or just don't care that much. We see so many failures of them just not getting the concepts of file storage and files and moving them and where they're located on the computer and stuff like that. But I feel like where Apple has gone with iCloud, with the tremendous, you know, very strict siloing per app and pretty much no file system, everything's just kind of a collection of documents in each app, I feel like that's going too far in the other direction.
It doesn't cover the problem space. It just doesn't. Like
right.
we all recognize. Even it doesn't even cover the problem space for casual people. It solves like there's nobody for whom that solution is adequate. I found because even just like my parents, like once they can't find their stuff and I explain the siloing, they're like, oh, well, that's dumb. How do I do that? And I'm like, I don't have a good answer for them. Like, I'm not going to say nobody, but there's so few people, you know. And so is that the first step and they have a master plan? Did they want to try that and say, hey, maybe this is adequate, you know, because they don't care, like, what we nerds will just use the apps that work with Dropbox, right? But, like, they haven't figured it out yet. They have not even come close to covering the problem space. And you talked about, like, the simple small, simple, but powerful tools. Like, that's the continuum. It's like, you know, Unix, where, you know, the ideal of Unix, you have a bunch of tiny single-purpose tools that you can chain together to do amazing things, but nobody can figure that out, right? And at the other end, you have like a big red button that you press and it just pops out.
On the other end, you have Microsoft Excel.
Well, no, Excel is actually a good example of like a small, simple tool that you can assemble, because their simple tool is, we have a grid. And there's a few simple things that regular people know how to do with the grid. And people are amazing at taking Excel. It's like, oh, a two-dimensional grid. I can solve any problem with that. Because it's like Lego blocks. You know, it's a terrible solution, but they can understand this one simple tool, right? Well, Unix, you know, these series of simple tools, you can make up your solution. But the other end of the spectrum is, there is no small reusable part. There is no Lego brick. There is no thing that you can snap together and make a solution. There's just one big shiny red button, and you press it, and it does whatever the hell we say this thing's going to do. And that is inadequate to cover the things that people need to do. And there's, you know, that's documents in the cloud at this point. There is a huge gap between those extremes, and there's got to be something in the middle that can work for us. And it would be a failure on Apple's part to ever surrender and say, fine, it's a file system. So, like, they've got work to do, but I hope they don't just give in, you know?
Right, because I think it would be an equally significant failure on their part to say, we've solved it, it's done. This cloud, this is stuff, this is it, we're done.
It's fine, you just got to get used to it. And, they realize that. I don't think that anyone thinks that. Anyone ever, anywhere, who's ever used documents in the cloud.
All right, we should wrap it up. You want to have some kind of outro? People have been asking for an outro to the show, so you know when it's ending. So you can look at our website, atp.fm, for Accidental Tech Podcast. Follow us on Twitter. We have Syracusa, S-I-R-A-C-U-S-A, Casey Liss, C-A-S-E-Y-L-I-S-S, and Mia Marco Arment, M-A-R-C-O-A-R-M-E-N-T. And that's about it. Go rate us on iTunes so that we can get more people and stuff. And... I don't know. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring. What do people usually put in these outros?
I thought you were going to sing a song. You're not going to sing a song?
I don't think I can. I'm not really in the mood to sing tonight. Maybe we'll record one when I'm in the shower one time, then I'll sing to you.
Looking forward to it. I think Twitter handles are good, and website URLs. You probably just don't have to spell them. That'll make them go by faster.
Yeah, because we all have long, spellable
names. Yeah, and you know, my last name cadence, it's 323. SIRACUSA. That's the cadence. Just so you know.
Oh, I've been doing twos.
Oh, no, it's threes, because that's how you have to do it. That's what drives me nuts about the stupid Google Authenticator things. Do you use that for the two-factor?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so they've got a Google Authenticator app, which is great. It integrates with Dropbox, and I have three of them on there now. It's one app, Google Authenticator, that gives you just the number. It's your second factor, right? And it's six digits, and they shove them all together. I'm like, come on, guys, what planet are you on? Like, it's two sets of three. Like, everybody knows you don't put six digits together, so your eyes go crazy in the middle when there's repeated digits and you screw it up. That's just unbelievable to me. They didn't put a freaking space or a hyphen or something. It's two sets of three.
Please put that as the lead-in, for the love of Christ, please.
That's definitely going somewhere.